Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date, March 10th, 2016, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Shared Decision-Making for Pain Control in Older ED Patients. And our guest skeptic this week is Dr. Tim Platts-Mills. Tim is an assistant professor of emergency medicine, director of clinical research, co-director of geriatric emergency medicine at the University of North Carolina. His career goal is to improve the quality of emergency care for older adults through research, research mentorship, and support of the larger community of geriatric emergency medicine researchers. Tim's research group is currently developing a protocol to screen for elder abuse in the emergency department. Tim also serves as the decision editor in geriatrics for the Annals of Emergency Medicine. Whew, I think I'm getting older just reading all that stuff, Tim. Well, welcome to the SGEM.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, you know what? It's always great to have the authors on to discuss their research. And you know what? If we've got an author on to discuss their research in greater depth, then we must be doing an SGEM hop. So where's Chris Carpenter? Chris, where are you?
I'm here, Ken. Thrilled to be back on the SGEM and equally ecstatic to welcome Tim to the SGEM. Did you know that he wrote the chapter on pain management in the elderly?
I did not know that.
Thanks for mentioning the chapter, Chris. My partner in crime for that was Yula Wong, and she gets a lot of credit for raising awareness about the challenge and importance of treating pain in older adults in the emergency department.
Well, this is a great article, Chris, to review because it combines some of my favorite issues. And for me, I really like talking about pain control or oligoanalgesia. And we've covered this before on the SGEM, and specifically looking at children with Anthony Crocco. And he made a great rant-thony on pediatric pain control.
Yeah, well, Ken, pain control in the elderly is just as important. SGEM episode number 138, Hip to Be Blocked, reviewed the topic of regional nerve blocks for hip fracture patients. Oligoanalgesia is a big deal in the elderly. So this paper, looking at pain control, caught my interest.
And to top it all off, we get to combine pain control, geriatric emergency medicine, with shared decision-making.
A trifecta for a great SGEM hop.
So give us a case.
So this is a case we probably see quite frequently. 78-year-old female, history of osteoporosis, trips and falls while rushing between flights at the airport. She comes to your ED. You don't know her. She's from out of town. She's got right wrist pain. And after your evaluation, you order an x-ray. She's got a Colles fracture. No other injuries identified. Your initial response, give her some acetaminophen, see if that works. You splint the fracture, prepare to discharge her, and then she's going to catch her next flight home, and you contemplate the pros and the cons of various pain meds. Personally, if you suffered a wrist fracture, you'd favor whatever analgesic provided sufficient relief to get you back to daily activity and nothing more. You decide to ask the patient for her pain management preferences, but you wonder, what's the role for the ED shared decision-making in older adults?
Well, I think most clinicians, Chris, are familiar with the idea of informed consent or informed decision-making, but I'm not so sure that everyone's as familiar with this concept of shared decision-making. So who's credited with the genesis of this shared decision-making model?
Well, it's not that long ago. We go back to 1998, and Valerie Billingham is credited with proclaiming "Nothing about me without me," and that was at the Salzburg Global Seminar. This statement really captures the vision that medicine must always consciously respect human dignity. Her statement is credited as the genesis for shared decision-making in medical decision-making.
Well, Tim, I want to bring you in on this because your paper is focused on shared decision-making. So I'm wondering if you could explain to the audience, how did you use shared decision-making or what did you mean by shared decision-making in this research project?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question and sort of central to understanding the paper. The short answer is we used a validated instrument, which is the SDM-Q9. And the SDM-Q9, as you can imagine, is 9 questions which get to the issue of shared decision-making. You know, an example of one of the questions is, you know, the patient has to agree or disagree to the following statement. And the statements are things like, my doctor helped me understand all the information about the different pain treatment options. So that's how we did it in the paper. I think more broadly, there's a question of like, what were we trying to get at? I don't think the SDM-Q9 is perfect, but I think it was pretty good. And for the purpose of getting a paper past reviewers, it was good to use a validated questionnaire. We did tweak the questionnaire. We put in about pain treatment so the patient would understand when we're asking those questions. When we had the statements, they would understand it was about pain treatment. But really, the ideal questionnaire would be one that had like basically followed nicely the concept of shared decision-making, but also followed what people are actually going to do in clinical practice. And some of the things in the questionnaire don't really fit. So one of the statements is, the physician made it really clear to me that there was a decision to be made. Now, we don't have the time to like clarify that there is a decision to be made. We should get on with it. So, you know, sometimes the questionnaires, as often the case in research, sometimes the questionnaires that are validated do some things that we don't really like embrace in clinical practice. But I thought this was a pretty good one. I think the essence of shared decision making for me is two things. One is an exchange of information. And then the second part is the decision. And the exchange is important here because it's not simply a doctor telling the patient, well, NSAIDs have these side effects. It's also the patient just kind of sharing with the physician, hey, this has been my experience. I generally don't tolerate NSAIDs, or I had a stomach ulcer once and it bled. Okay, that's important information. So I think it's really two pieces, exchange of information and then sort of a joint decision.
Well, if you want to know some more about shared decision making, there's a really good article by Barry et al. In the New England Journal of Medicine 2012. And they lay out some key elements to shared decision making. And one of them is that the patient and the doctor, they need to collaborate on reaching a decision about the management strategy for a given problem.
Yeah, and it first requires a situation where there's more than one reasonable option that exists.
And shared decision making also requires that the patient be given the information they need to choose among those competing acceptable strategies.
And it shifts the focus away from disease and towards understanding the patient's experience of illness.
And you know what Barry says? He says that shared decision making is the pinnacle of patient-centered care.
And then there's this small issue in the United States of the Affordable Care Act of 2010. Affordable Care Act emphasizes that shared decision-making that includes communication strategies to help patients choose the best treatment option should be occurring.
Although the three prong of evidence-based medicine includes research evidence, clinical expertise, and patient preferences, medicine has too often underemphasized the unique perspective of patients and caregivers.
Shared decision-making in a controlled office setting is challenging with multiple levels of confounding variables like the patient level, the provider level, the evidence level, and the system level barriers to the delivery of best medical care.
Well, you know, Chris, if it's a challenge in the office setting, I'm sure there's some skeptics out there going, whoa, guys, you know, how can I possibly do shared decision-making in the chaotic ED environment?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I'm not one of them, but Tim and his team tackle one of the most challenging ED populations, the older adult. Several aspects of the study merit skeptical scrutiny, your favorite, Ken, in order to derive a valid lesson that we can improve patient healthcare experiences and outcomes everywhere with.
Well, give us a clinical question that we'll try to answer with his publication.
So does shared decision-making for analgesic selection in older adults discharged home from the ED with acute musculoskeletal pain improve pain relief?
So Tim, what's your actual citation?
Yeah, so the first author on the paper is a young man named Wesley Holland, who's a senior at UNC, is going off to do Teach for America next year, and a great kid. And he and I worked very closely developing the protocol, and I was senior author. He was first author. And the paper is a prospective evaluation of shared decision-making regarding analgesic selection for older emergency department patients with acute musculoskeletal pain. And it was published in Academic Emergency Medicine in 2016.
And of course, it is hot off the press. So Chris, let's run through the PICO. What was the population?
Adults over age 60 with acute, moderate to severe, as defined by 4 out of 10 or greater on a 0 to 10 pain scale, musculoskeletal pain, who are discharged home from the ED.
And what they excluded was those with cognitive impairments, pain for greater than a month, daily use of opioid pain medication prior to the current pain onset, headache, chest pain, abdominal pain, lack of telephone for follow-up, or non-English speaking. What was the intervention there, Tim? What'd you do?
So this was not an interventional study. This was an observational study, which is important in terms of interpreting it. So we did not go around and tell providers, hey, this is how you do shared decision-making, go at it. We asked patients while they were in the ED some information, got them enrolled in the study, and then we called them about 24 hours later and asked them to assess the level of shared decision-making they received. And that was sort of how we characterized the exposure. So it's not an interventional study. The exposure is measured just after the ED visit. And then at 1 week, we measured the outcomes, which were pain, satisfaction with the pain medication side effects.
So it was a descriptive, prospective, convenient sample observational study?
Yes.
Okay. And so there would be no comparator group then?
Right. I mean, to the extent that we're interested in the exposure as being shared decision-making, you can say that different patients got different levels of exposure to shared decision-making just based on the natural variability in physician practice.
All right, Chris, what was their primary outcome that they were looking at?
The change in pain severity from the time of ED arrival to the one-week follow-up phone interview.
And then they had a number of secondary outcomes, which were satisfaction with the decision made in the ED about how to treat pain at home, and satisfaction with the recommended or prescribed pain medication, and finally, the medication side effects. So, Tim, you don't even have to put out air quotes. You get to actually say the author's conclusions.
In this sample of older adults with acute musculoskeletal pain, the reported desire of patients to contribute to decisions regarding analgesics varied based on both patient and provider characteristics. Shared decision-making was not significantly related to pain reduction in the first week or type of pain medication received, but was associated with greater patient satisfaction.
All right, so Chris, let's go through the quality checklist for observational trials.
Sure.
So the first question is, did the study address a clearly focused issue?
Yes, and the question is, are patients' perceptions of shared decision-making associated with positive or negative outcomes in acute pain management for musculoskeletal pain in older adults?
And did the authors use an appropriate method to answer their question?
Perhaps, although a randomized control trial that measured the fidelity and the methods used to provide shared decision-making at the bedside would yield more definitive cause-effect relationships, the observational study does give preliminary evidence that can serve as hypothesis-generating data for future studies.
Was the cohort recruited in an acceptable way?
No, this was a convenient sampling, so there's uncertain selection bias, and the authors note that.
Question 4, was the exposure accurately measured to minimize the bias?
No, there's no assessment of if or how shared decision-making actually occurred in the emergency department. The study only evaluates patients' perceptions of shared decision-making.
Was the outcome accurately measured to minimize bias?
Yeah, the authors used validated instruments, not validated in ED settings or among ED patients, but validated instruments to assess individual patients' preferences for shared decisions with healthcare providers.
Have the authors identified all important confounding factors?
Maybe. The authors evaluate for the most important confounders in shared decision-making for older adults, like cognitive impairment, and for all patients in general, health literacy. But as noted below, they use screening instruments that appear to less accurately identify dementia and limited health literacy.
How was their follow-up? Was it complete?
No, only 94 out of 157 patients, or 60%, had one-week follow-up, and only those 60% were included in the analysis, with those lost to follow-up more likely to be female and more likely to be Black.
How precise are the results?
Precision estimates for the primary outcome were not provided.
Well, do you believe the results, Chris?
Yeah. The results indicate variable interest in older adults to engage in shared decision-making. Demographics of this population, including a limited health literacy of 27%, match those of other ED studies.
All right, question 10. Can the results be applied to the local population?
Yeah, absolutely. The variable acceptance of shared decision-making in outpatient pain management probably reflect the general geriatric ED population in most sites, but the implications of this research, I mean, how to use it to improve patient-centric outcomes, a little bit unclear still.
Well, and the final question is, do the results of this study fit in with other available evidence?
There's little research exploring ED shared decision-making in older adults, but the demographics of this population match those of other geriatric populations in the ED, so probably.
Probably. All right, well, let's get to those key results then. The patients were mostly female, about two-thirds, with a mean age of 70 years. Three-quarters were white and in severe pain at triage. Participants had a mean pain reduction of 2.1 on that 0 to 10 pain scale that you mentioned earlier at that one-week time frame, although two-thirds still had pain scores of 4 or more. Tim, I was wondering, though, can you give us the preference for shared decision-making?
Yeah, right. So we use something called the control preferences scale, and we asked patients just one question, which was, how much do you want to be involved in the decision? That was the essence of the question. And then we took those responses and we grouped them. If you were sort of, you wanted to be very, you know, completely controlling or mostly controlling the decision, that was considered active. If you wanted to be like 50-50 share with the physician, that was collaborative. And then if you were mostly or completely passive, then that was passive. And so the breakdown was the following. So 16% of patients wanted to be active, 37% said they wanted to be collaborative, and 47%, so almost half, said they wanted to either let the doctor make the final decision or, you know, have the doctor mostly make the final decision.
And the characteristics that were associated with a greater desire for active role in decision making or a college graduate, care received from a nurse practitioner, and kind of surprisingly, care received from a female provider.
Yeah, so this was a key point from the study that was totally unanticipated. And I'll say, you know, in sort of favor of doing some observational research before you jump into a clinical trial, we would not have learned this if we'd done a clinical trial. It was really fascinating to see that actually patients appeared to be varying their response regarding how involved they wanted to be in the decision based on the characteristics of the provider. If you ask a patient who has a female provider, they were more likely to say, oh, I want to play an active role in the decision. You could spin that a million ways. You could say, well, female providers are less, you know, domineering and maybe they're more passive, and so the patients react to that. Or maybe that actually the female provider is more actually likely to listen to the patient. The patient's picking up on that, and so they're like, oh yeah, I want to be more active because I know this female physician is going to listen to me. I think the bigger point is that there's a context in which preferences for decision making occurs, and it is not simply that patients walk into the ED and they know whether they want to do shared decision making. They're reacting somewhat to the environment, and I think that's interesting.
So after splitting the perceptions of the degree into low, moderate, or high into groups, there was no significant association between that 1 week pain improvement and any perceived degree of shared decision making was noted.
In addition, there was no difference in the number of analgesic medication side effects or the type of pain medication prescribed, so not more acetaminophen, not more NSAIDs, and not more opioids.
The one positive outcome we did see was that patients who perceived receiving more shared decision-making said they were more satisfied with the pain medication.
Here we go with the EBM nerdy section, Chris. And we, of course, want to start by congratulating Tim and his team for addressing such an important topic and a challenging one at that.
Yeah, adults over the age of 65, those aging baby boomers, the silver tsunami, they represent about 18 to 20% of most ED patient volumes in hospitals in the U.S. at least. Surveys of ACEP membership in 1992 and again in 2006 indicated that providers in the emergency department believe that geriatric patients are more challenging to diagnose, more challenging to manage. They consume more time and resources, yet older adults often leave the ED feeling dissatisfied with the care received. It's so frustrating. Therefore, Tim and I co-authored these geriatric emergency department guidelines that have been endorsed by ACEP and SAM and the American Geriatric Society, the Emergency Nurses Association, and last weekend by CAPE.
Yay, go Canada.
And the effort is to attain the triple aim for these patients, improved healthcare experience at same or lesser cost with improved outcomes. And prompt, effective analgesia is obviously essential for an improved patient experience.
All right, so let's go through some of the critical appraisal part, though, for this nerdiness. And how many points are we going to bring up, Chris? How many? Come on.
Oh, it's got to be five, Ken.
It's got to be five. So the first one was screening tool for occult cognitive dysfunction. Because one of the confounders for geriatric shared decision-making is the presence of an occult cognitive dysfunction.
And multiple studies indicate that delirium and dementia are usually unrecognized in the elderly in the emergency department.
Well, therefore, these authors used a six-item screener as one of the exclusion criteria in order to reduce the impact of occult cognitive dysfunction.
Yeah, that's my research. So this is where Tim and I are going to come to blows. However, multiple ED validation studies have demonstrated that the six-item screener is inaccurate to either rule in or rule out occult dementia.
More accurate dementia screening instruments like the AD8, the Ottawa 3DY, or the short blessed test could be used in the future.
Yeah, and in addition, there's ultra-brief screening instruments for acute delirium that could also be used.
Yeah, we spent some time looking at the Ottawa 3DY, and I'm not convinced it's the best tool. One of the things they ask about is the date. So like today being March 10th, like I'm probably 50-50 on knowing the date. And if you only miss one of those Ottawa 3DY, then you're sort of like considered to be cognitively impaired. So that puts me in like cognitively impaired every other day, which makes me a little nervous for our patients. And I think so for this purpose, we were excluding patients who were cognitively impaired. I think a bigger question is in a clinical trial of shared decision-making to improve pain management for older adults in the emergency department, how cognitively impaired can somebody be before you have to say, you know what, we can't do shared decision-making anymore? Because if they don't know the date, well, you can still certainly ask them whether they've had stomach ulcers or, you know, if when you take opioids, do you get nauseous or do you get constipated? So I think I would, you know, in the trial, I would actually tolerate some degree of cognitive impairment and try to keep those patients in, because I think those patients actually can give you useful information and are likely to benefit.
So the second point was health literacy. And this is another patient-level factor that can negatively impact the effectiveness of shared decision-making, which is based on the gold standard of the S-TOFLA, and it's limited in about 25% of urban ED patients in the United States.
Yeah, and the studies have shown that the ED clinicians, if you just use Gestalt, we don't detect health literacy that's bad subjectively. We can't do it.
And furthermore, health literacy is exacerbated by cognitive dysfunction. So in older adult studies, both health literacy and cognitive impairment should be measured concurrently, as these authors did.
However, the choice of the realm R may not be the best choice based on ED research indicating that the newest vital sign is more accurate to identify a subset of patients at least less risk of limited health literacy.
Yeah, so I think the first point is to reiterate what you guys have said, which is health literacy is hugely important, especially when you're dealing with pain management. We're sending these patients home for the most part. Acute musculoskeletal pain, older olds, they're going home, and they don't know the difference between Tylenol and NSAID, and even some people who are fairly educated don't know the difference between Tylenol and NSAIDs and opioids, and so it's all mixed up. Oh, wait, there's Tylenol in my opioid? Who put that there? They don't have any idea about it. So that's, I think, one thing to be aware of. In terms of the methodology here, we did look at newest vital sign. It turns out Darren DeWalt and Mike Pignoni are two of the authors there on the development of the newest vital sign, are both at UNC. Mm-hmm. Compared to Realm R, in the emergency department doing prospective work, we put a premium on basically minimizing survey burden for patients. Realm R is basically 8 words that they have to pronounce. And they can either pronounce them, or they either pronounce them correctly or not. But it only takes about 30 seconds to look at the words and go through them and try to pronounce them. Newest vital sign is tough. It's 6 questions. You have to look at a label. I think it's a genius in terms of the way they set it up, because it really has like a, you know, that you look at a nutritional label and you try to interpret what's the information is there. But actually, like, it ends up being like multi-step word problems that's sort of like 8th grade algebra, like, but hard. You know, the whole thing doing it, I think it's 3 or 4 minutes. And that was sort of a no deal for us. So I hear you, Chris, about it being a more accurate instrument, and it probably separates the men from the boys more. It's harder to implement in the ED, and so that's a trade-off.
All right, so let's talk about point number 3, and this is descriptive studies. Descriptive studies are limited by the measures employed to capture, define, and characterize the phenomenon. The current study tries to evaluate this nebulous activity called shared decision-making, and a process that many experts still cannot reach consensus about how to define.
Yeah, they use the control preferences scale to characterize the extent to which patients wish to lead or follow in reaching medical decisions with the physician.
And the authors use the shared decision-making questionnaire, or the SDMQ9, to explore patients' perceptions of how effectively or ineffectively their ED provider used shared decision-making while managing their current musculoskeletal pain.
And as we just discussed with dementia and delirium and health literacy, any instrument that performs well in one setting, like primary care, post-op settings, or nursing homes, may not work quite as well in the emergency department.
And using appropriate methods, instruments like these should be validated in the ED setting before they can be confidently applied and interpreted in the ED setting.
Yes, the SDMQ9 assesses only perceptions of shared decision-making, but does not try to evaluate what actually occurred. The authors note that the observing patient involvement in decision-making, the option scale, assesses shared decision-making using a third person or a video camera, thereby replacing the uncertainties of patient memory or subjective interpretation.
Well, shared decision-making is inherently subjective, mm-hmm. though, so even if a pristine methods were used, you know, pristine methods by providers to engage willing and able patients in shared decision-making, if the patient's next day's perception are that shared decision-making attempts were suboptimal, that it may not matter what the third-party observer believes.
No doubt it's tough to measure.
Yeah, I think it would be great to get a video in the room and see what kind of conversations are occurring. I think the short version on that study is that we'd be disappointed, because I think a lot of times there's not much conversation going on. I think that the point that you guys sort of implying here is like when you ask patients the next day, how is that conversation? I think there's probably a lot of social desirability bias going on, and the patients who tend to be, you know, polite and well-mannered, if you ask them, oh, did the doctor explain things to you? You know, they're going to say, oh, yes, they were very nice, kind of like, you know, unless they're in a lot of pain or horribly pissed off for some reason about, you know, having to wait 4 hours, then they're going to say something nice. And that may or may not really reflect to what degree there was shared decision making. The fact that there was such a big difference in shared decision making for the satisfaction kind of and not for pain kind of suggests that basically, oh yeah, I was really satisfied with medication. Oh yes, and they had these nice conversations. But when we ask them something like, how's your pain? We're not seeing a difference there. So I think there may have been problems with it, with assessing the exposure of shared decision making. I think to make the problem broader, or sort of overcome that challenge, I think the next step for this research is really a randomized trial. And then the question becomes, well, if I'm going to randomize Ken and Chris to, like, one of you guys is going to do shared decision making, one of you guys is going to do usual care, like, how do I get Chris, being skeptical that he is, to do shared decision making in the ED? And what does that mean? How much time is it going to take? I think it shouldn't be intimidating, because really it's just a matter of asking. I think at its bare bones, it's just asking a patient, you know, what are your experience with these medications? What do you think is going to work for you? I'm thinking about prescribing this. Does that sound like a good idea? And so it shouldn't take a ton of time, but I think there's still an ongoing question of, like, if you're going to do that trial, what is that intervention on the level of the physician?
All right, well, let's move on to point number four, and that was adjusting for multiple covariants. And this is another aspect of this study that leaves significant uncertainty, that there are attempts, you did make attempts to adjust for multiple covariants, age, gender, race, initial pain severity, health literacy, but the sample size was only 94.
Well, I have a couple defenses. One is we don't claim that we hit the primary outcome. In fact, we claim no difference. So I'm not taking this as like, hey, we won, that we hit the ball out of the ball, you know, hit the ball out of the ballpark, and this is the answer, and you should do shared decision making. So the next defense would be, we do show the unadjusted differences in, you know, change in pain for levels of shared decision making, and we show the adjusted, and those don't change very much with adjustment. Now, when you do observational studies and you do adjustments, sometimes you see big effects from adjusting and sometimes you don't. In this case, we didn't see big effects, which makes me think that we're probably not, like, there are probably not huge confounding problems here. But of course, we don't know that for sure. And to your original point, which is the sample size is a little small, for sure, I think we would learn more if we had 1,000 patients than 100 patients. We wouldn't have gotten the study to be published in 2026. So.
And you also mentioned, Tim, that you made no attempt to educate the providers about techniques or barriers to shared decision making, nor how to evaluate patient comprehension. For example, how did individual providers communicate comparative effectiveness estimates for acetaminophen versus NSAIDs versus opioids? Who knows? And did they use studies, or did they just use their generalized gestalt?
Right. We don't know to what extent this is communicated at all. And you can sort of consider yourself in your own practice. You're probably not giving them ratios or something. You probably say something, well, like, acetaminophen works pretty well. You know, you're probably going to put a sales pitch if they're old and you really think they're going to have high risk for falls and you don't want to give them opioids. You're going to give a sales pitch for acetaminophen, which right. They may buy or not. If they, you know, there's a lot of variance in practice around NSAIDs. The Beers criteria say don't ever use NSAIDs for older adults, although that's technically for long-term use. My personal opinion is you can give NSAIDs for short-term use in patients who are not high risk. But I think there's a lot of variance in NSAID use, you know, in terms of how it's recommended. There's another question here from your example, is the risk fractures. You give NSAIDs to people with fractures because there's questions about healing. I think there's a ton of variance there in terms of how emergency physicians practice related to those medications. I think probably there's a lot of just, hey, I'm going to give you some Vicodin or some Percocet and get out of here. And there's not a conversation. And then probably a lot of times, the only time there's a conversation, if the patient sort of calls the physician back to the bedside and says, well, hey, I don't think it's going to work.
So the fifth and final point was statistical versus clinical significance. And the adjusted difference in the satisfaction with pain medication, it was 2.7 in the low shared decision making versus 3.9 in the high shared decision making. While that may be statistically significant, there's a question whether this is really clinically significant.
Yeah, two points I'll make. One is, I love this question of statistical significance versus clinical significance, because it sort of forces people to think of, like, what did you actually find that was different? One point is, generally, if a study is kind of a pretty small sample size, like 90 patients, it's unlikely that you're going to see a problem of statistical significance but not clinical significance. Much more often, that kind of shows up when you have like a million patients. But then that's a legitimate question. So the difference between the two scores is sort of a difference between somebody saying somewhat satisfied versus quite a bit satisfied. And I think it's up for debate whether that's really important a difference. And I don't think for a trial, like, we're going to get super excited about satisfaction with pain med as a primary outcome. I think you got to hit pain or function to really invest in a clinical trial in this. And so if we go down that road, we will define a primary outcome as a difference in pain of probably a 1.5, you know, somewhere around 1.5 or 2.0 or 0 to 10 scale. That would be a difference that I think would be clinically important.
All right. Well, that ends the nerdy section. Now we're into the final sections, and that's comparing the author's conclusions, so your conclusions, Tim, to the SGEM's conclusions. Chris, what do you have?
Well, we agree. Tim's a conservative guy. We agree with Tim's conservative conclusions. In the single center, convenient sampling of older adults without overt cognitive impairment and with acute or subacute musculoskeletal pain, the majority of patients desire some shared decision-making in selecting their outpatient analgesia. The perception of receipt of ED shared decision-making seems to be associated with improved patient satisfaction. Not really surprising. And there does not seem to be an effect on which analgesics are prescribed or in the side effect profile at a week.
So the SGEM bottom line is shared decision-making in selecting pain relief medication in older adult musculoskeletal pain patients is preferred to varying degrees by most patients, but in this study is not associated with faster recovery, less side effects, or a predisposition to any particular analgesic. Chris, give us a case resolution.
So a poor lady with the wrist fracture who tripped at the airport, you spend a couple minutes, maybe 5 minutes, discussing the side effects and the mechanism of action of acetaminophen, NSAIDs, and opioids. And since her pain is minimal with her fracture splinted, and because she already has problems with intermittent constipation, she's not really interested in opioids, even if you prescribed a bowel regimen with it. So she collaboratively decides to use acetaminophen, which was already effective in the ED, and you discharge a comfortable, contented patient to catch the next flight home.
So how are you going to take this new paper hot off the press and apply it clinically?
Not sure. Since the authors did not assess the actual delivery of shared decision making in real time in the ED, and they didn't provide a control group, the cause-effect relationship of shared decision making for patient-centric pain outcomes can't really be determined by these results. As the authors note, a clinical trial is required to confirm this benefit, as well as to better understand the how and the when and the who the issues of shared decision making delivery in the ED. The objectives and priorities for these future studies, I hope, will be the focus of the 2016 Academic EM Consensus Conference on May 10th. I hope that every SGEM listener will attend that.
Chris, what are you going to tell that patient at the bedside to explain the whole shared decision-making process? Because while it may be new to the practitioner or the provider, it might be new to this patient.
Yeah, and some of the older patients in particular, the baby boomer generation from World War II, they might prefer paternal medicine, and that's fine if that's their preference. But what I tell them is shared decision-making is a collaborative process in which the healthcare provider and the patient review treatment options and then decide the optimal choice for that individual patient. This small study indicates that in older adults with acute pain in the ED, patients who receive shared decision-making in selecting a pain medication are more satisfied with the choice of pain medicine received, but don't get faster pain relief, don't get less side effects, then I would ask the patient, do you want to review the effectiveness and side effects of different pain medicine options?
Time to announce the Keener Contest winner. And last week's winner was Chip Lang. Chip is a PA from Missouri. He knew the Lego movie had cyanoacrylic glue, known as the Craggle, as a super weapon. Chris, what's the Keener question this week?
The question is a tough one this weekend. What is the medical legal case from 1957 that introduced the term informed consent for the very first time?
Ooh, if you know the name of the case that introduced the term informed consent, then send your answer to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line, and the first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize.
So now is the time for the SGEMers to join the conversation. What do you think about this SGEM Hop episode? What questions do you have for Tim and for his team? When else do you get to ask the author questions firsthand to get responses? So make sure you reach out on Twitter, Facebook, or the SGEM blog. The best social media feedback will be published in Academic Emergency Medicine.
Well, thanks, Tim, for coming on the SGEM and discussing your hot-off-the-press publication.
Yeah, Ken and Chris, thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure, and congratulations on this effort to link the work of Academic Emergency Medicine to a broad audience of clinicians.
Yeah, it's our pleasure, Tim. Anything else you want to say before we end this episode?
I'll just mention we got some funding from the Hartford recently to Hartford Foundation to develop a video to educate older ED patients about pain medications. The video is about 6 or 7 minutes long. It's sort of the first step in shared decision making that takes a little bit of time for the clinician. And so we're trying to use that as a way to sort of make that conversation happen. And we are collecting pilot data now for a clinical trial. So hopefully those efforts will come to fruit, and we'll be able to share that with you guys soon.
All right, Tim, as our extra special guest skeptic, you get to give the SGEM tagline.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.